case, United States v. Woods, Bennett, McDonald. Mr. Stevens?
Good morning. I'm Jay Stevens, representing the appellants Clint Woods, Steve Bennett, and David McDonald. These cases have been consolidated, and the issues are essentially the same in all three cases. The first issue raised by the government's motion is the issue
I have with your appeal is that you waived any right to bring a, or your client waived any right to bring a post-conviction proceeding, and isn't that what this is?
Judge, that's it is a proceeding that is post-conviction.
Well,
I would not agree that it is a post-conviction proceeding as reflected in the appeal waiver. The appeal waiver consists of two parts. We talk of an appeal waiver.
Look, there's an appeal waiver, but the appeal waiver is conjoined with a waiver of I expressly waive my right. I agree not to contest my sentence or the manner in which is in any post-conviction proceeding, including but not limited to a proceeding under 2255. How much broader a waiver could you imagine?
Judge, I think that that has to be read in the context of the plea agreement. And in the context of the plea agreement, I think it certainly is a valid interpretation of the appeal waiver and the waiver of post-conviction that I will not appeal this sentence, and I will not challenge this sentence in a post-conviction proceeding. Challenge means to contest.
I also agree not to contest my sentence or the manner in which it was determined in any post-conviction proceeding.
And I think, Judge,
that's what you're doing. This is a post-conviction proceeding to alter his sentence.
The post-conviction proceeding is not this appellate proceeding, Your Honor. The post-conviction proceeding, if there was one, was at the district court level.
Oh, please, how can you have you waive the post-conviction proceeding? I don't understand you. The appeal waiver is immaterial, it seems to me. It's the post-conviction waiver. You have this sentence, you have an appeal, if you want, or you couldn't appeal because you had an appeal waiver. Then, you know, there's a change in law and you want to now change your sentence. So, but you're barred from that, from proceeding in the district court any further by this waiver provision.
If this court took that to its logical conclusion,
it's not a matter of a logical conclusion. It's what it says.
What that would mean, Your Honor, is that every 3582 motion that's been filed in this country, that there has been a waiver of post-conviction, must be denied by the district court, and that's simply not happened.
So, well, but it should happen, right?
The position of the United States Attorney's Office.
Tell me how you interpret that to accept 3582.
Judge, I interpret that. I agree not to contest my sentence. That doesn't say that I will not, if Congress changes the law and provides an opportunity for a new proceeding.
That's ridiculous. That makes it completely empty. Look, it says you can't even challenge it under 2255. That is, if it were held if the statute under which your client was convicted were held unconstitutional, you couldn't challenge.
Well, 2255 says that the original proceeding was illegal in some fashion. It was unconstitutional.
Right. And, of course, that's a much stronger claim for post-conviction relief than just some change in statutory change, right?
But the right to challenge the constitutionality, the right to challenge the legality of the sentence, the right to challenge the manner in which the sentence is imposed is entirely different.
Oh, please. It doesn't even say that. I also agree not to contest my sentence. It's obviously contesting his sentence, the client.
So let me try to see are you trying to say that under 3582C2, your motion doesn't attack the original sentence, but it modifies a sentence that was correct at the time given, but is now incorrect due to changes in the guidelines? Is that basically your argument?
That's precisely what I'm saying, Judge Williams.
So you're contesting the sentence.
I'm seeking to modify the sentence, Judge.
What difference does it make? That's contesting.
Well, modifying is not...
Come on. Look, if I'm sentenced to 10 years in prison, I say, no, I'd actually only like to be in prison for 1 year. I'm contesting that 10-year sentence. even though I'm not, even though I'm asking for modification, I'm not asking to be let out immediately. That's contesting.
I understand what the court's saying, Your Honor, but a reasonable reading might also of the term contesting.
I think you're mangling English language if you think there's a reasonable reading that lets that out.
You think he's unreasonable, so there we are.
But to contest is to say the first sentence was wrong. It was not wrong at the time it was imposed. Congress has provided a different sentence structure.
That's just like if you were challenging a statute that was constitutional, believed to be constitutional when it was passed, and then later the Supreme Court holds it's unconstitutional. And then you couldn't bring a 2255.
I would agree you could not bring a 2255.
So in other words, a little statutory change creates a right to break the waiver, but a constitutional violation, no, you can't do that. Well, what sense does that make?
And the difference, Your Honor, is that when the court says that the first sentence was unconstitutional, it says the first sentence was wrong. And a defendant has given up the right to go back and say...
This is ridiculous. You're saying if I was wrongfully convicted, I can't do anything. If I was properly convicted, well, fine, then I can get a new sentence. Now, does that make any sense?
I think it does, Your Honor, in the context of this is what the parties agreed to. The parties agreed, I'm not going to go back and say my first sentence was wrong. Once
that
judge...
That's, of course, not what it says.
It says I will not contest. I will not go back and say it was wrong.
You're contesting your sentence. You want a lower sentence.
Let me ask you this, because the strongest case you seem to have, and I'm not very clear what the waiver language was, in the Tenth Circuit case, U.S. versus Chavez... That was that case where the defendant waived his right to a direct appeal or to collaterally attack his sentence, but filed a 3582 motion based on post-sentencing amendments to the guidelines. What was the language? I mean, the Tenth Circuit found that that it didn't fall within the scope of the waiver, but what was the language of the waiver in that case? Was it identical to the waiver here?
Judge Williams, I don't have the language in that case. I would be glad to try to supplement that when I get back to the office.
Because the waiver you have, I'm just curious. My guess is the waiver there was a little more narrowly construed than the waiver here. But I didn't get a chance to pull that.
And I would note that it is much more the practice than the exception that appeal waivers are included in plea agreements across the country. To date, I've not found any court, district court or appellate court, that has held that an appeal waiver or a waiver of this nature constitutes a waiver of a 3582 motion. In fact, I've not come across any case where the government has even raised the issue. So as far as I'm aware, the government's position in this case or in these three cases is unique in claiming that this waiver is so broad as to include a 3582 motion.
There are several circuit cases with plea agreements that expressly waive the 3582C. You found those cases, because there are cases where the waiver did include waiving 3582C2 review.
I did, Your Honor, and certainly if the government wants a 3582 waiver, it is not only better practice, but I think it avoids having to ask the court to interpret an agreement not to contest my sentence in a post-conviction proceeding includes a 3582, because what the government is asking the court to do is to construe that provision and to interpret it to include 3582. These are contracts between the...
You, of course, are literally contesting the sentence that is now in effect as a result of the district court having denied the relief you sought. You now believe that that's an illegal sentence. You regard it as based on an erroneous determination of the amount of cocaine that he handled.
Again, I would
That's not contesting. I don't know what is contesting.
I would point out to the court that there are two waivers. There's an appeal waiver, and there's a waiver of seeking post-conviction relief. And I would suggest to the court that the ordinary meaning given to post-conviction relief is at the district court level. If the post-conviction...
If you can't seek post-relief, how does it ever get here?
If you can't seek post-conviction relief, it never gets to the Court of Appeals. That's correct.
When you went in, it was after the conviction, post-conviction. You went in and asked for some relief, which you thought you were entitled to.
When we went in on the 3582,
well, that's post-conviction.
We went
relief,
in on a motion pursuant to a statutory grant by Congress to the Sentencing Commission.
Gotcha. But what you did was you had to go to the district court and say, look at this, and now you've got to modify our sentence, right?
That's correct.
That's post-conviction relief.
And let me retract my that's correct to this respect. We didn't go into court and say you've got to grant relief because relief is discretionary with the judge. We went into court and said, Judge, you have the authority to grant relief.
Well, that's asking.
And my position is...
And then when he didn't give it to you...
In these cases...
You said it was an abuse of discretion.
He did not give it to us.
That's the
remainder of my
discretion?
Brief. I'm sorry, Jess?
Was that just abuse of discretion? Or was he required to give it to you?
Once we get past the issue of the appeal waiver...
Forget the appeal waiver. When you ask him to modify the sentence, ask him, as you said, you have the authority to do it, and he didn't do it. Was that simply an exercise of discretion which he's entitled to do?
That was not an exercise of discretion because he based it on an erroneous conclusion of facts. And the conclusion of facts was that the amount of drugs attributable to Mr. Bennett, Mr. McDonald, was greater than 4.5 kilograms of crack cocaine, a finding that was not made originally by the original sentencing judge, who was, in fact, a different district judge.
So, in other words, continuing with what Judge Bauer is saying, he wrongfully denied you post-conviction relief.
He wrongfully denied us relief under a statutory grant by Congress through the Sentencing Commission to the district judge.
Post-sentence, so to speak.
And it happened to be post-sentence. That's correct. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Steve. Mr. Grimmer?
Thank you, Your Honor. William Grimmer for the United States. All three plea agreements in these cases bear my signature. I am the drafter of the plea agreements, and I included the exact identical language, probably thanks to word processing, in all three. And in all three instances, one before Judge Miller and two of the cases before Judge Sharp, those particular, there was discussions concerning those particular paragraphs. Now, I believe in these particular cases that there was, in fact, a great deal of consideration exchanged between the parties. I did note that in preparing for oral argument, I looked in the reply brief and looked at the law review article cited by Mr. Stevens, which talks about appeal waivers and public policy. And I did note that, you know, one of the things that appeal waivers they discuss gives some finality to this whole guilty plea process. I also noted that in that article, they spoke to 22 defense attorneys and only 9 prosecutors. I wasn't quite sure why that was. But they also did look at 971 cases from 2003 from the Sentencing Commission and did find that in a third of the cases that, in terms of guilty pleas, there were no appeal waivers. And if you take out the Ninth Circuit, there were approximately half the cases in terms of guilty pleas where there was no waiver. So I guess I go back to the fact that this was, in each of these three defendants' cases, something that was negotiated by the parties.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Grimmer. Are you contesting their ability to at least seek relief under 3582 in the district court?
No.
So then, so why wasn't this, but you're just saying that once the district court, so you're saying that they could go back on 3582 to the district court, make the motion, but then can't appeal it.
Correct.
I mean, it just seems to me that if they're going back on that modification, in your view, that isn't that like seeking some post-conviction relief? I guess your view would be, well, but it's not on appeal. We don't care. They can go to the district court, but if the district court rules unfavorably, they can't do anything about it in the Court of Appeals.
Correct. I mean,
when they went to the district court, why didn't you object on the basis that I think that's what Judge...
My next question. Yeah, sorry. Why didn't you object? Because it seems to me it's nonsensical. If you don't, if they can't appeal it, why not object? Why not stop? Isn't that, I mean, I understand it's seeking that would be post-conviction relief in the district court. So it would be of no moment. I mean, no consequence if somebody can't appeal. So why don't you respond to that?
Well, I think it was just simply as a matter of fairness that, you know, I think that number one is...
You're willing to give him a shot at the district court, but not a shot at the district court.
Well, the district...
Especially when you look at we're talking about the crack, the modifications to the guidelines. I mean, when you say it was a matter of fairness, it was a matter of fairness to have it go back to the court. So that's the disconnect I have in this argument. That they were allowed to go, you didn't object to it, you thought it was fair for them to get a fair shot at the district court because it was a modification. I'm assuming that's why you agreed to that, but they can't bring it upstairs.
Correct. And I believe that if you look at the original plea agreement and the bargain for language, we were going to have the district court make the final determination. Judge Sharp said, I believe it was to Mr. Bennett, do you understand, Mr. Bennett, during the plea-taking process, I am the final, and he didn't complete the sentence. He also, I believe, Judge Miller said the same thing to Mr. McDonald. Do you understand that I'm it? No matter what happens after this, I'm the one that has the final say.
But I don't understand. You have this very broadly worded post-conviction waiver.
Correct.
Why is it that you think it doesn't apply to 3582?
Well, I think technically you could make that argument, and I believe that as a matter of policy, we were told not to raise that, and as a matter of fairness to defendants, and that was the position of the department.
So you've waived your waiver, but actually, that's the clearer part, because the waiver could be thought a waiver of appeal from the conviction, not from permissible future proceedings, right?
Well, if you say I waive my right to appeal my sentence on any ground, I think that's pretty specific. Now, obviously, if you want to construe that against the government and against the drafter...
No, I don't want to. I'm just curious.
I also agree not to contest my sentence or the manner in which it was determined. I don't know if they were necessarily contesting, but asking for some additional relief from the district court. Perhaps that's the thought process behind giving the defendants, each of these defendants here, an opportunity to present their positions to the district court.
Let me give you a hypothetical. Under 3582, you know, a district court can on its own motion resentence a defendant. So if the court on its own had raised this motion and determined that the court wanted to look at it and modify it and had so modified the sentence and reduced it, would the government still argue the plea waiver issue?
You mean on appeal?
Yes. And let's say the court ruled and, you know, drastically reduced the sentence. I guess your position would be, well, we didn't waive. The appellant waived.
That is correct, Your Honor.
I've answered my question.
I'd like to, at least if the court decides that I've waived my waiver and wants to go to the merits, I do think it is important to at least address the merits specifically with each of these three defendants. I'll start with, I think, what I believe to be the easier two, and that is Clint Woods and Mr. McDonald. Mr. McDonald was before Judge Miller, and I believe the sentencing memorandum as well as the sentencing transcript makes clear that
Initially, Mr. McDonald contested the amount of drugs that were involved in the pre-sentence report, but then withdrew those objections. And that involved 345, I believe, kilograms of crack cocaine and approximately 230 kilograms of powder cocaine. So he withdrew his objections. In fact, all three defendants here, nobody objected to the drug quantities in the pre-sentence report. Mr. Woods...
It didn't matter to him, right? He only had to have 1.5. So
right.
It's only after 3582 that the 4.5 becomes material. So shouldn't he have a chance to show it was less than 4.5?
No. No, I believe that he had at the time that the drug quantities were presented in the pretrial services report and they were alleged, he certainly had a right to contest those. He started to contest them, then decided to withdraw, perhaps in light of the other considerations he was getting from the government concerning 5K1, dismissal of other counts, promises of immunity in exchange for his cooperation. So the answer to that is no. I don't think he has a right to go back and reopen the whole sentencing process.
With respect to Woods, I don't know if your statement just now was with respect to which defendant.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. That was Mr. McDonald.
Yeah, McDonald. But the district court specifically said it was not going to attribute the full amount to him because he was not further up in the conspiracy.
I believe
doesn't that contradict the original finding to hold him accountable for the entire amount now?
I believe that my recollection of the record is that was when in the pretrial services report there was a recommendation that there were grounds for an upward departure based upon the amount of drugs, and that was what the court said. Judge Miller said he was not going to consider an upward departure because he was not, let's say, on the top rung. But the court did make mention of the fact that Mr. McDonald was responsible for all other acts that were foreseeable, even though he did not handle the drugs. Judge Miller said on page 2 of his sentencing memorandum, Mr. McDonald concedes the quantities asserted by the government, so his base offense level is 38. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I believe that comment was in the context of an upward departure consideration, which Judge Miller decided not to do.
Now, with respect to Woods, and you concede that the district court's reason for denying the 3582 on Woods was incorrect. That had to do with, you know, the mixture of the different types of drugs under the 706 and 711 amendments.
Absolutely. After I took a look at it, and it took me a long time to figure it out, I concluded that was Judge Miller was in error in that statement. But that, so I don't. Yes, the answer to your question is yes. I believe that was a mistake on the part of the district judge. But in light of the sentencing transcript and the findings made by Judge Sharp, clearly, again, Mr. Clint Woods did not contest the drug quantities, and was rightly so. He was involved from 94 through 98. He was central to the conspiracy. He was the enforcer, the muscle for the conspiracy. So probably in light of those facts, there really wasn't any reason to contest the drug amounts. A little more problematic is obviously Mr. Bennett, if you get to the merits of the appeal, but again we think a fair reading of the pretrial services report and the mention of the drug quantities that there were in fact he was a distributor for Ray Woods, that he was involved on a fairly regular basis, his home was used as a distribution point. Kilogram quantities were coming from Chicago and being cooked on a weekly basis, being cooked into crack cocaine, that a reasonable inference or fair reading of that information certainly would support Judge Miller's conclusion that there was more than 4.5 kilograms originally found by the trial court, although it's not specifically stated.
Okay, I just want to get back to our original issue. So as I understand the Justice Department policy, even in a waiver situation of appellate rights, the Justice Department does not contest or object when this kind of motion is made before 3582C2 motion is made in the context of the crack issue, the department says it's fine to let someone file the motion and to have that motion heard by the district court, but that there should be no appellate review.
It was my policy that, and with the approval of my superiors, that these defendants be afforded that opportunity. As to if it's the department policy, I can only say it was the Northern District of Indiana policy and my directives from my superiors. And it would have been I would have encouraged my superiors to adopt that position.
And let me ask you this. Are you familiar with the Sentencing Law and Policy blog?
I am not.
Okay, there was a February 8th posting that seemed to suggest that assistants in other jurisdictions are using plea agreement appellate right waivers to bar defendants from invoking 3582C2 relief on the new crack guideline. You're not aware of that, though?
I'm not aware of that, and I'm not aware that that's the policy of Mr. Kapp in the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Northern District of Indiana.
Okay.
I do have one final comment I would like to make, and that was when Judge Sharp was talking about Clint Woods and about the appeal waivers. Judge Sharp made a comment, which I think is sort of apropos, and that is that he said he didn't like the appeal waivers as a whole, and he said the last chapter on that has not been written yet in this context, and so it's sort of prophetic that we're here today. Back in 2008, he didn't like the appeal waivers, and here we are talking about them some 8 years later. So thank you.
And so I guess my question is now, and I understand you can't represent what your U.S. attorney would do, but certainly in the future to avoid such issues, it makes a lot of sense, doesn't it, to include that specific statute in a waiver just like you do 2255?
We can always do a better job in drafting appeal waivers, I'm sure.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Grimmer. Mr. Stevens, how much time does he have? 3 minutes?
Mr. Grimmer, of course, is known in our district for his fairness, and that's certainly a matter of record. If a district...
Well, he can waive his, post-conviction thing. That's fine, waiver. But he's clinging to his appellate waiver. And, it says, I further expressly waive my right to appeal my sentence on any ground. This, of course, is what you're doing. I was also struck by what he said, that the district judge told the defendants that he was it. they couldn't go above him. They couldn't challenge any rulings he made if they signed the plea agreement. So... doesn't that make clear that you're barred from this appeal?
I think that creates an ambiguity, Your Honor, because the agreement says I waive my right to appeal my sentence, and it's contained in a plea agreement as to that charge
yes,
at that time.
He's appealing his sentence.
He is appealing his new sentence, not the sentence that was imposed pursuant to the plea agreement.
My old sentence.
It does, however, say I waive my right to appeal my sentence. It doesn't say and all future sentences.
Sentence. This is his sentence he's appealing. It's what? Not someone else's sentence.
What
he's
new
appealing.
Sentence is he appealing?
The new sentence that he's appealing, well, there actually was no new sentence appeal, but the new ruling is what he's appealing.
So first he said he can't appeal his old sentence, not his new. I mean, you said the bar is the old sentence, not the new sentence. Now we discover... through Judge Bauer's question, he's just got the one sentence. He didn't get a new sentence. So that's what he's appealing on a new ground, any ground, he's appealing his old sentence.
But what he's appealing is not the sentence that was imposed by the court originally. What he's appealing is the denial of the motion.
What difference does it make? I mean, that's such logic chopping. It's perfectly clear.
Well, it does make a difference, Judge, in that it creates an ambiguity, which should
be... There's no ambiguity. Where's the ambiguity?
The ambiguity is in the phrase, appeal my sentence, could
there
just as
no
easily...
There's ambiguity. This is his sentence. It is not your sentence.
You're appealing the ruling not to change the sentence.
Appealing the ruling not to change the sentence, but not appealing the original sentence, because the original sentence was validly imposed.
Well, that chases the tail around the flagpole. Not bad, though. I appreciate it.
With regard to the substantive issues, as to
your time has expired.
All right, thank you, Your Honor.
So thank you, and you were you were appointed in these cases, were you not? In fact, you're up again. You're up in the next sentence.